Hello, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss with the Center for American Progress. With me today is my colleague and co-host of Foreign Entanglements, Rob Farley. Rob, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Pretty good. How's the weather in Kentucky? Is it really hot and humid as it is here in D.C.?
No, it's actually about 75. It's quite delightful. And my office is so cold. My office is so cold because they only really have two settings in my building, warm and cold.
Warm.
And so they have it on cold right now, so I'm actually wearing a sweater and a hat.
Ah, I am not. anyway, so today we're talking about a few things. We're going to talk about the current fighting in Gaza, or the current bombing of Gaza by Israel, and rocket attacks by Hamas and other factions in from Gaza into Israel. But also, we're going to get toward the end, we'll get into a discussion of the ongoing Dick and Liz Cheney, I should say. Because they're a duo act,
right?
And Rand Paul, the fight between those, which is an interesting, pretty obviously an interesting fight, but you know, within the GOP over foreign policy,
right? The intra-GOP fight has always been a concern or an interest of this program, right? It's
that's
always
right.
been something that's fascinating.
That's right. So first Gaza. I was actually over there a little over a week ago. Came home. So I was there with my family just for the 2 weeks leading up to, and we literally got out. We flew out about 24 hours before the rockets started coming toward Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I was there when the three teenage boys,
mm-hmm.
The bodies were found. And over the next few days, things really started to get ugly. First of all, with roving gangs of Jewish Israelis out looking mm-hmm. for Palestinians to attack and finding them in many cases. And in one particularly horrific case, a Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Abu Qader, kidnapped and burned to death, apparently burned alive. And then after that, an American Palestinian boy, Muhammad's cousin, Tariq Abu Qader, beaten
mm-hmm.
during a protest pretty severely by Israeli police. And all of that continuing to step-by-step escalate into more intense rocket attacks and then Israeli strikes.
We obviously know where we got to, right? But along the way, was there a sense of certainty that we were going to arrive here with both parties going at it like this, or did it seem like there are clear off ramps along the way? I mean, I guess one thing that's come to light is that the Israelis understood that the three teenagers were dead probably before they started looking for them.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it was very clear from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
from Israeli sources that they were almost certain that they were dead.
Mm-hmm.
There was a gunshot heard, at least one in the emergency phone call that was placed by one of the teenagers after
mm-hmm.
they realized they had been kidnapped. They had received no demands. They'd received no communications from the kidnappers. So
mm-hmm.
a large preponderance of the evidence said to the Israeli authorities that these boys were dead. But nonetheless, Netanyahu used the pretext of a search for these three boys while telling the Israeli public that they were alive
mm-hmm.
to just carry out this broad crackdown against Hamas in the West Bank,
mm-hmm.
jailing several hundred Palestinian activists, some of whom with only the most tenuous connections to Hamas, and I think about 50 to 60 of whom had been released as part of the Gilad Shalit deal,
right?
All of which served to very effectively provoke Hamas. You have, all during this time, since 2012, the last time we did this in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
there was a ceasefire brokered by Egypt then under the authority of Mohamed Morsi.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, Hamas has largely, not entirely, but largely ceased its own rocket fire from Gaza. You had other groups, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Popular Committees, and others who would fire these rockets from time to time. But I think you would get, from Israeli security sources, you'll get a recognition that Hamas had had effectively enforced this ceasefire. And it's worth noting, and this is very rarely reported
mm-hmm.
in the U.S. press, is that you have pretty regular incursions and violations of the ceasefire by the Israelis as well.
Right.
Whether we're talking about actual incursions into the Gaza Strip or a refusal to ease the closure on Gaza as was promised by Israel in the
mm-hmm.
ceasefire. So it's not as if these provocations were only going one way, but, you have a kind of just, you know, a kind of steady status quo that doesn't involve a massive conflagration, even though one side is clearly getting the way, way shorter end of the stick, and that would be the Palestinian side.
Right.
But here, I mean, you have a situation where Netanyahu felt pressure but also decided to essentially kick the hornet's nest by carrying out this crackdown.
And so was Netanyahu's hope that they would be able to essentially undercut the unity government at the knees and drive Hamas back into Gaza effectively? Was that what's going on here?
I think it's hard to say for sure. I think mm-hmm. that's a fair analysis. You know, he obviously jumped on this. You know, they've offered constantly, immediately mm-hmm. insisting that Hamas was responsible. Having produced no hard evidence that Hamas was responsible, I don't think we'll ever see hard evidence. And to be fair, it's almost, you know, it's kind of like there is a sort of standing order amongst Hamas cells in the West Bank. It's like whenever you can cause trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there had been kind of a pullback from that in the wake of the unity government.
Right.
From the information I've seen and people I spoke to when I was over there, it seems that the people, the guys who are suspected of having carried out these kidnappings were a particularly extreme and uncooperative faction associated with Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possibly the case that you have, you know, this extreme, you know, group that was that didn't like the reconciliation agreement, because in fact the reconciliation happened largely on Fatah's terms.
Right, and so undertook a predictable set of behaviors that would lead to a predictable outcome.
Exactly. Yes, we have an extremist group acting in extremist ways to destroy or make life very difficult for moderates.
Right. So, right now, and I don't know if you saw the news, but apparently one of the an Israeli civilian has been killed by rocket fire. I mean, just to keep us topical, and Netanyahu has apparently released a statement that discussed how the broad measures would be taken. Where are we going to be going with this? I mean, is this going to lead to the ground invasion, or is it going to, you know, are there going to be heavier air attacks, or what sort of steps do you see us moving forward now?
Well, it's clear that Netanyahu really does not want a ground invasion.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pressure on him is especially after the death of an Israeli civilian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think it is worth mentioning, we've got probably, I think it's over 150, maybe closer to getting close to 200.
Yeah, I thought it was 189 or something like
those.
Yeah.
Palestinian civilians or Palestinians mm-hmm. killed, some of them clearly Hamas people, we're not sure how many, but definitely right. dozens and dozens and dozens of civilians, men, women, children, elderly, mm-hmm. killed in Israel strikes. And now we're going to have one Israeli civilian killed mm-hmm. because Iron Dome has done a fantastic job. Their Iron Dome rocket and missile defense system has done a fantastic job in protecting Israeli cities. But now that one Israeli civilian has died from these attacks, Israel will use this to, you know, or
now,
will be pressured to really take the gloves off.
Now, Ted Postol and others have sort of brought up some questions about how fabulously the Iron Dome has actually functioned, right? Whether setting aside whether it's economical, but, you know, whether the kill vehicles are actually being hitting the warheads.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, brings up the questions, right, are passive countermeasures really reducing the death toll or limiting the death toll in Israel? I mean, the rocket fire never killed that many people in Israel, and it's clear that Iron Dome has reduced that, but it's reduced a pretty small number to a smaller number.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, no, I've seen some of that, and again, but I think there's a number of things that are interesting about that. Mm-hmm. But one is, as you said, the cost of each kill vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's. You know, in terms of it, you know, at least incurring costs, which is part of a kind of guerrilla insurgent terrorist strategy, whatever term you would like to use, that's, you know, straight down the line, you know, mm-hmm. incur much, much greater costs on the part of your enemy than you mm-hmm. yourself, right?
Right, 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 exactly.
So, yeah, I think it, at this point with the ceasefire, and I think people should take a look at the ceasefire and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, honestly, I want this, the fighting to stop immediately. I'm happy with anything that ends, you know, this fighting that ends the destroying of homes and killing of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But the ceasefire that I read, the copy that was going around last night, it gave Hamas absolutely nothing. And it's kind of, it's you know, the kind of a standard of diplomacy that you've got to give both sides something to get an agreement.
Right.
I think people can rightly say that Hamas, you know, was, you know, You know, Hamas chose to launch the missiles. It's true. No one forced them to do that, but at the same time, no one forced Netanyahu to take a, you know, to undertake these the provocations that he undertook as well. So I think clearly there's blame on both sides here, and therefore both sides have some claim to get something from a ceasefire. I mean, if we're going to go back to a status quo that overwhelmingly benefits Israel, which is what the current draft that I saw, you know, that was what it offered. It's not difficult for me to understand how Hamas could have said no, as it appears they did.
Now, how is this playing out, to your knowledge? How is this playing out in the politics of the West Bank right now?
Well, I mean, you've got some Fatah leadership who are always sort of pleased to see Hamas getting beat up.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, unfortunate and short-sighted in that, A, you know, Palestinians are dying, and if you're claiming to be the leader of the Palestinian, you know, part of the leadership of the Palestinian movement, you shouldn't be celebrating that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also an understanding among many in the leadership in the West Bank is that, you know, this is what Hamas has got right now, you know, is rockets. I think we shouldn't overstate the extent to which they are isolated and weak. I think Mark Perry has a good piece in Foreign Policy today where he kind of takes issue with the conventional wisdom being that Hamas is on the brink of collapse.
Mm-hmm.
People say this all the time. And yet there they are. I think they're just, any understanding of the situation requires a recognition that as kind of condemnable and abhorrent, personally, I find a lot of Hamas's policies and ideology, they're an ingrained part of the Palestinian polity. I mean, they have deep roots in this, and they have to be dealt with in some way,
right?
More than just bombing them every couple of years. But I think especially amongst kind of younger leadership, some of whom are part of the official leadership and some of whom aren't, they understand that that for the Palestinian national movement to move forward, there needs to be unity. And to the extent that this undermines the reconciliation government and the potential for unity in elections, as it almost certainly does, that's just completely negative.
Now, it goes without saying that right now, this dispute is not the only going concern in the Middle East, right? The Syrian civil war continues. The Iraqi civil war has re-erupted. Jordan is concerned about the spread of ISIS and ISIL. Is this playing out because of that? Is this sort of playing out in regional isolation? Is this, or do you expect greater regional effects from the latest eruption of the conflict?
I mean, I think there's no question that the region is, you know, each of these countries is deeply involved in their own affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, the Sisi government consolidating power, the Syrians with their civil war, the Iraqis. But I think there is a sort of baseline, you know, there's a baseline significance to this conflict. For a number of reasons. One of, you know, the role that kind of it plays in the kind of grand story that people in the region have about Western intervention and Western interference and colonialism.
Right.
Which, like it or not, that is the context in which they continue to view Israel.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, you know, just Jerusalem, you know, the significance of Jerusalem, which, you know, despite what you would hear from the right wing, is not something that the Palestinians just invented. You know, Jerusalem is a significant place for Muslims.
Right.
And much, much more so for Palestinians. I mean, it's long been an economic and social center, but for Muslims more broadly. So, I think there's no question that we just haven't seen this sort of activism or mobilization around this particular iteration of the conflict as we have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it just kind of gets added to the pile of grievances, and that's
right.
No good.
Right. I mean, is there... And I think Avigdor Lieberman came out sort of what was effectively a statement that was pro-ground invasion. Is there any upside for Israel to move back into Gaza and to forcibly evict or destroy Hamas, right? I mean, it seems like Netanyahu thinks it's a terrible idea. It seems like everybody thinks it's a terrible idea except a certain sector of the Israeli right. I mean, is there a logic for them sort of outside of just spitballing? Is Lieberman just spitballing, or is there a real argument?
I seem to think that he's just spitballing. I mean, mm-hmm. he's not like a super genius, but mm-hmm. he's smart politically. Mm-hmm. And he understands that there's value in kind of taking a hard line that no one will ever do. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
So if BB doesn't do it, he can, for the next few years, always be like, well, I wanted to go in and take Hamas out.
Right.
And, like, whispering on the side, thank God they didn't do that.
right.
We've gotten blamed for the huge disaster and the fact that we're now, you know, entirely reoccupying Gaza. But, I mean, just as an aside myself, I mean, one benefit, I only see one benefit, and it's not a benefit that comes close to outweighing all the costs mm-hmm. And negatives of a quote-unquote reoccupation, but it would just be an awareness and a recognition that Israel does, in fact, occupy Gaza.
Right.
Which is the case now. It's not, they do not occupy it as they did before, but they still, by any definition of occupation, they control mm-hmm. its borders, they control its airspace, they control the seas, they control entrances and exits, apart from the Rafah crossing, which is controlled by Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they enter Gaza with impunity whenever they want. There's just no other way, you know, maybe it's an occupation minus,
mm-hmm.
But they are still the sovereign of Gaza.
Right. Right, by almost, yeah, I think by, under any conception of international law, that would be, mm-hmm. you know, Gaza's not sovereign in any sense, so.
Right.
Well, I mean, just to... Not to exactly change the subject, but to move on a bit. I mean, I guess before this started, because your trip started before this started. I mean, what were you gathering? What did things feel like before? I mean, were you there before the kidnapping of the three?
No,
you weren't. So
about a week and a half, 2 weeks after.
So you were. I mean, we were firmly into crisis mode by the time you arrived in.
Right. Yes.
In Israel,
you know, the West Bank crackdown had been ongoing for, you know, a week and a half. 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people were definitely tense. There was, you know, there was always, you know, the news and the headlines and the stories. Where are they?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I really have to, you know, it was really, it's really something for a government to, I mean, let's just step back and recognize it's really something for a government to kind mm-hmm. of do that to a population.
Right.
I understand, I guess, on the one hand, why you wouldn't want to release information that might jeopardize any search. But on the other hand, to run this entire social media campaign, you know, hashtag
right.
bring back our boys, when you were almost sure that they were dead, seems to me extraordinarily.
Right. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the situation, but there's to my understanding, there's a similar event just happened in Calgary, where there's a missing family of three,
yeah.
And they haven't been missing long, but the Calgary police have determined that they are most likely dead, and has sort of been very forthright about that.
Yeah.
You know, it seems, especially in a situation like this, it seems the responsible activity is to increase public information rather than use it
right.
As an excuse to settle scores, right, or as an excuse
right.
to dismantle a particular sort of network.
Right.
I mean, and that seems especially true given, you know, the very unusual relationship of Israel with its citizens, right, in terms of hostage taking and
mm-hmm.
bodies of hostages taken and released and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems a bit much to maintain these expectations for a while when you really didn't know that things were going to end up the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be some anger about that, right? I mean, you know, I guess it would seem there would be some anger about that from the Israeli public.
Yeah, I think so. Unfortunately, I mean, most of the anger I've seen, though, has been directed at the Palestinians.
The Palestinians, right.
You know, you have, you know, people on the left, progressives and others
mm-hmm.
who are pointing out, and I think even some in the center who are pointing out what a cynical move this was
mm-hmm.
by Netanyahu and you know, his government.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, the focus was on, you know, and I understand this, the fact that these boys were taken and killed
mm-hmm.
And anger at the people who did that.
Now, and you, so you're in Washington, D.C., and you follow this much closer, much more closely than I do. I mean, you follow all of these issues much more closely than I do. How has the reaction in groups in the United States who are particularly interested in the region, so especially Jewish groups, but also Islamic groups, how has the reaction in the U.S. played out any differently than what we might expect so far? Has there been any cleavage in sort of American Jewish response to the campaign?
Not really that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can see. I mean, I think there's a lot more. You know, in terms of the information that's getting out there, I think mm-hmm. this is something that's been increasingly true over the past few years. Is, you know, thanks to social media, thanks to the web, thanks to Twitter, that, you know, people who are inclined to go and find it mm-hmm. have much, much greater access to real reporting on the ground, so they can get a much more accurate picture of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of establishment groups, it seems pretty much the same old thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, defend Israel, stand with Israel. Israel has the right to defend itself. There's very, very little recognition or acknowledgement that the Palestinians might have a need to defend themselves against a 47-year military occupation. But that, you know, that's how this conversation works in D.C. I think you have groups who are trying to kind of offer more historical context. I think I'm part of a panel tomorrow at New America Foundation that will be discussing some of these issues. So, you know, I think you see a broader array of voices.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of my questions is at what point do you actually see this, change, reactions on the Hill, in Congress? And for the most part, those reactions have been extremely disappointing. I would take a moment here to just talk about this young American Palestinian boy, Tariq Abu Qader, who was beaten savagely
mm-hmm.
on video by Israeli policemen. I attended his hearing in Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
the Sunday we were there, so that's, I think, the 6th, yeah, July 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And just complete, I mean, his family has not been contacted by either his member of Congress or his senators
mm-hmm.
from Florida. There was an article in the Hill newspaper today by Tariq's cousin, I believe, who went to visit Tariq's congresswoman, Kathy Castor, and was treated
mm-hmm.
very rudely by her staff. It's just extremely shocking. And I don't think there's any question that the situation, the response and the treatment and reaction from this office would have been very, very different if this were an American Jewish kid who was beaten up by Palestinian police.
I don't
think there's any serious doubt. But unfortunately, American politics being what they are, you can have this outpouring of sympathy for, and deservedly for the three boys who were kidnapped and murdered, but very little, nothing approaching that for Mohammed, who was kidnapped and burned to death, or anything approaching that for Tariq, who was beaten,
right.
you know, on video. There's no question. It's not an alleged thing. I mean, it's right there in color. This kid handcuffed, lying limp on the ground, and these two masked adult men beating the crap out of him.
Mm-hmm. We can come back to this, but do you want to take this opportunity to segue a bit into a conversation about American politics? Because this is one where, you know, we have yet, as you suggest, to see significant cleavages, even between the parties on broader Israel-Palestine questions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are related issues that we obviously do see strong,
mm-hmm.
and related Middle East issues that we do see strong cleavages between the parties, but and then also some intra-party cleavages.
Yeah.
And I know you've been following, as I think some people have, sort of the big intra-party cleavage in the Republican Party over a hawkish foreign policy, which, you know, doesn't happen on this issue, but is nevertheless is going to have implications for Israel-Palestine, if depending on how it plays out. So, what are your thoughts on how we're going, which direction we're moving there?
Sure. I mean, well, I think the most immediate thing is this ongoing, you know, kind of slap fight between
mm-hmm.
the Cheneys, Dick and Liz.
Mm-hmm.
America's sweethearts, Dick and Liz Cheney, and Senator Rand Paul as the kind of most, you know, the guy who, you know, who's kind of the standard bearer, but there are others like Justin Amash and others
mm-hmm.
kind of around this non-interventionist, and I won't use the word isolationism because
mm-hmm.
that it's kind of this slur
mm-hmm.
that's thrown around. I think Justin Logan from Cato has written very well on this. I've written about this. The idea that Rand Paul, I mean, I don't agree with him on a lot, but the
mm-hmm.
idea that he's an isolationist, I mean, just is to define the term completely out of existence.
Right.
I've said before, and I think it continues to be true, that Rand Paul, you know, is fine with a level of global engagement and leadership that actual isolationists would find just mind-bogglingly imperialist.
Right.
But you have this interesting thing, like, over the past few weeks, you've had Dick and Liz emerge from under their you know, rock or their cave or wherever they hang out, trying to undertake this basically a, exhuming whatever we want to call it, neoconservatism or mm-hmm. just George W. Bush first term
right.
interventionism.
Right.
You know, they have this big piece in the Weekly Standard, defending the decision to invade Iraq. And it's just, you talk about creating their own reality. I mean, it's just Exhibit A in how right. it just seems completely detached from you know, this plane of existence.
All right. Did you see, I think it just came out today or maybe yesterday, but I saw it today, the comment that, and it was, I guess it was off the record, but that Vice President Cheney had spoken to some bankers about the potential. If it had been up to him, they would have invaded Iran and Iraq at the same time.
Yes. Right. So,
just met with dumbfounded silence.
Right. Yeah, so which is, shorter Dick Cheney, if mm-hmm. I had had it my way, would have been 10,000 American troops mm-hmm. killed rather than just, 4,800. And, it boggles the mind. Mm-hmm. Really? That's the lesson you draw. We should have gone bigger.
Right. I guess in terms of, and of course I'm one of Senator Paul's constituents, in terms of how this conflict is playing out, it's been really interesting for me to follow. Over the past few weeks, the sort of the neocons seem to have had the mic, or they've had the conch for a bit because yeah. of how... because of, obviously, how the situation in Iraq has been playing out, right? That this is sort of in their wheelhouse in a way that it's not in the Paul faction's wheelhouse, right? That they get to complain a lot about how Iraq is playing out while the Pauls...
Obama lost Iraq, right?
Right, right. Well, the Paul faction doesn't really have an answer to this, right? They don't necessarily have a dog in this fight other than to say, well, we should have got out. But that puts them too far on... the side of Obama, and so it's much more wise, given sort of
right.
the realities of Republican politics, just not to comment on these questions.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see, how this continues to change over the next couple of years, but also especially in the midterms, right? How many of the Senate candidates swear fealty to the one side or the other?
Right. No, I think Liz Cheney's abortive. Mm-hmm. Senate run was an interesting marker there.
Mm-hmm.
But the failed attempt to knock off, what's his name in North Carolina? I'm blanking.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I also don't remember the name, but I know what you're talking about.
But also what's really interesting, and this is actually something I sort of just like threw out there as mm-hmm. soon as, Cheney showed up again. And I think it's proven to be true. It's like when, sure, bring up Iraq. Let's debate that because when the American public, hears about Iraq, all it reminds them is we're really glad to be out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's as I see it. It's not like there is going to be any major reassessment of the consensus, which is fairly strong, which is that it was a mistake.
Right.
It was not worth the costs were not didn't come close to outweighing any benefits. It was a bad idea, and to have Dick Cheney of all people making this argument,
right?
Hey, yes, go for it. That's a great idea.
In that sense, the Obama administration is probably quite pleased to see some of the chief neoconservatives, Wolfowitz and Cheney
right.
and so forth, leading the charge on this. I mean, it allows them to put an absurdist tone on the on the critique that's coming in, the critiques which are there's certainly a legitimate statement to be made. There are legitimate voices of critique, but at the same time, it's great that Dick Cheney is the primary one. And people
absolutely.
And the Weekly Standard is sort of bearing his standard, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I couldn't be more pleased with that.
Right.
So Dick and Liz have started this new organization. I forget what it's called, but I would bet a dollar that it's got strong in the title. Because they're very strong.
The Organization strong. For the Strong Heritage of Protecting Democracies?
You know, the strongening of America.
of protecting enterprising democracies?
Protecting foundation for the enterprising strongening of America.
Right, because if there's anything, you know, if there's anything else the right needs, it's another alphabet, another three-letter acronym, so they can give out, you know, more interns and feed more interns into the congressional machine.
That's right.
I mean, it's actually it's a fabulous organizational strategy. It's worked very well for that wing of the Republican Party, but you know, there would seem to be some limits someday. One would hope. So yeah, no, I mean, I guess it will be interesting. You know, again, from Kentucky, it's particularly interesting not only because Senator Paul is one of my senators, but also Senator McConnell, who I guess. I'm a little bit more optimistic about his opponent than many are, but everybody's predicting that he'll be returned and he may be majority leader.
Yeah.
If the Republicans do take the Senate, McConnell's behavior will be very interesting because he's never he's always been regarded as a chameleon on these issues, right? One who doesn't really regard foreign policy as that important, but sort of is willing to tack to whatever wind. And so it'll be interesting to see which direction he feels the wind is blowing.
Right. You know, but just to get back to the inter-GOP fight, I mean, this is part of... I'm working on an article about this right now, but I think it is worth keeping in mind that even though you have this fight ongoing, it is worth recognizing how massively outgunned the kind of non-interventionist wing remains, both in terms of money, but also in terms of personnel. You know? So if something very, very strange happened and we ended up with a Rand Paul presidency.
It's not obvious who would staff it, right? I mean,
I do think it's almost certain that he would end up having to, like, dig into the AEI bench and all these other, which would be very, very interesting.
Right. No, you would have, it would be, I'm not saying that it would be worth it happening to see how it would play out, but it would be very interesting. It would be a very interesting development to see what the new best and brightest looked like on the Republican side. Because, I struggle to come up with anybody. He could completely denude Cato and wouldn't begin to fill the spots that he needs to fill and wouldn't have the expertise that he needs, right? And so what's he going to do? Go to, you know...
Right.
Nonpartisan think tanks, anything? No, it seemed very difficult.
But I think that gets to the challenge, right?
Right.
Is that for these sorts of kind of tendencies, ideological dispositions to gain? You know, you'd need to be president first, right?
Right.
To kind of gather this you know clique, coterie, whatever word you want to use, of experts around you who could then go forth and multiply.
Right. And I don't really get that sense of organization building from Paul yet, right? I mean, he's always been very successful in a number of ways. And there are probably people who are closer, closer to his organization in Washington and closer to his campaign here in Kentucky who have a better sense. But I don't get the sense of organization building, especially around foreign policy, from his campaign yet.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong. There could be something going on sort of beneath the waves that I'm not... sort of fully, you know, that would also be an interesting thing, right? Having sort of a genuine Paul partisan on at some point, whether here in Kentucky or somewhere else, but that would be a good idea for us in the future to do. Yeah. All right, well, I know. Do you have any more thoughts?
I'm tapped.
All right, well...
I've given you my best, man.
Well, Foreign Entanglements viewers, please, thank you so much for watching us today. We hope that, again, it's been informative and helpful and allowing you to navigate the day's events. And we also, I think Matt and I both deeply hope for peace between Israel and Palestine in the near future.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Talk to you soon.